Spending public funds efficiently and effectively is a challenge for governments around the world. But why are so many African states struggling with this?
So corruption is a problem because of its distortionary effects, but it's not the biggest problem.
Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. In today's program, the benefits of bringing legislators into the budget process to build stronger and more representative public finance management systems.
Because if you look at, there are many countries in the region where governments seldom spend all the money that they allocate themselves each fiscal year. There's just money being left on the table because there's no capacity to spend it well. My name is Ken Opalo. I'm an assistant professor at Georgetown University, and I study legislatures, policymaking around education and healthcare in Africa, and the politics of subnational governance in Kenya.
Ken Opalo is also the author of an article on the democratization of public finance management systems in a special finance and development online series marking the 60th year of the IMF African Department. Journalist Rhoda Metcalf sat down with Ken Opalo to talk about his research.
So in your article, you make the argument that in Africa, legislators, you know, the people who are elected by taxpayers, that they should be playing a bigger role in deciding how their government manages its budget and, you know, spends its taxpayer monies. So what's the role that legislators are playing now in the budget decision-making of African governments? And why do you think it's important that they be more involved?
So right now in many African countries, legislatures basically are overpowered by excessively powerful executive branches. So the budget process typically involves a lot of planning and thinking and incorporation of various interests on the executive branch side. And then many parliaments in the region basically get an up or down vote, which forces them to basically kowtow to the expertise and priorities of the executive branch.
Right, so they don't have any input in the actual development of the budget itself.
Yes, so they get given an up or down vote. And in many cases, they have to vote yes, because shutting down governments is often not an option. So, you know, this current situation is not optimal for two main reasons. One, it gives the executive too much power. Second, it fails to incorporate the priorities of the people. It makes budget reflect the powerful interest groups, which often are not, in many cases, are not aligned with those of the people.
Right. So you think that if the legislators had more of an influence in actually developing the policies and the priorities in the budget, that it would reflect more what the people's needs are or wants?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it would reflect more of the public's priorities. It would force discussions about the intra-elite level distributed politics that are often hidden under, you know, the technicalities that come from the treasuries. So that, you know, if we're allocating money for construction of a road, which is basically just a way to fund a construction company that's run by a friend of the president's, then, you know, why not have that discussion in public and have parliament actually debate? And if they so decide that this is a good way of spending money, so be it, right? That should be part of the process, as opposed to giving deference to the technical expertise of finance ministers in their treasuries.
So you say that the fiscal pact between electors and their elected officials has become stronger in recent years, that, you know, the public in Africa are expecting, demanding more from their legislators than they used to. How is that manifesting itself?
So it's manifesting itself in shifts in public spending in Africa. I'd say over the last 20 years or so, you've seen many African governments begin to spend lots of money on sectors like healthcare, education, agriculture, and of course the big infrastructure items, power generation and transmission, roads, dams, and whatnot. Now, in many countries, this has created expectations that incumbent governments have to do something big that's visible, right? So a good example is Kenya, where Following the transition in 2002, President Mwai Kibaki styled himself as a reformist infrastructure guy. He built lots of roads, which then created demand for big infrastructure spending for the next guy. So President Kenyatta did a lot in power generation and transmission. He built a brand new railway line from Mombasa to Nairobi, all because the expectation had been set that this is what presidents do now. And now what you're seeing also is that, you know, across Africa, many countries invested in universal primary education in the early 2000s, which was a big success. Enrollment rates are up. Now what you're seeing is, as you'd expect, increased primary enrollment created demand for increased secondary enrollment.
Right.
And so many are now spending money on secondary education. So these are, you know, the expectations have been raised because people see what governments have done in the past, and that has this ratchet up effect of demanding more of the governments. And that calls for a more democratized public finance management system, as opposed to what currently exists, which is the executive decides, parliament rubber stamps, and the public just pays the taxes.
Right. So you think now that elected officials, because of this public expectation, that if they were part of the process, that they would push an agenda that is more the needs of the people because they feel that pressure on them?
Yes. And what we're seeing now with the mismanagement of debt in African countries is partially a result of this mismatch between what the public wants and what the government has been forced to invest in, and the mechanics of managing public finance in the region. So lots of governments have spent money on infrastructure because that's what the public demands, but many of those projects were poorly thought out. The debt to finance those projects were not negotiated in good faith or made public transparently. The public was essentially cut off from those processes, which has meant that, you know, government sought to cut corners, inflated projects became the norm, and it's increasingly clear that this is not a sustainable approach. There has to be transparency in budget prioritization. If debt is to be acquired, there has to be transparency on how that debt is acquired and is spent, so that the system can withstand the incredible demand that exists out there.
So you're arguing for what you call greater democratization of the fiscal management in African countries. So how do you get there? I mean, are there African countries that have moved more in this direction of including, you know, elected officials in the decision-making process?
Yes. So Kenya is a reasonable example. Not perfect yet, for sure. But, you know, the Kenyan parliament has a lot of say in the budget process. It has capacity to actually scrutinize the Treasury's proposals. There's a parliamentary budget office with expertise. They routinely issue reports on proposals and numbers and figures that come from the Treasury. So the way to get there, it should be, the idea here would be this would be a long-term game of capacity building and an appreciation of the distributed politics that come with giving parliament power to oversee the budget.
So, I mean, when you say capacity building, whose capacity is being built in your scenario?
So in this scenario, both members of parliament who sit on the budget committee and parliamentary staff who are independent of the executive branch and can therefore independently verify the numbers and figures coming from the Treasury.
You also talk about public perception in Africa and how, you know, many Africans see their government as being corrupt when it comes to managing government monies. But you say that if you're going to improve that situation, there needs to be a greater understanding of how this, you know, government corruption happens in Africa. Can you explain more what you're talking about here? You know, why is it important to understand the nuances of corruption in order to deal with it?
Yeah, so corruption is a problem because of its distortionary effects, but it's not the biggest problem. Because if you look at, there are many countries in the region where governments seldom spend all the money that they allocate themselves each fiscal year.
So they have money left over?
Yeah, there's just money being left on the table because there's no capacity to spend it well. So, you know, fixing the planning process and involvement of the public and governments could help alleviate that part of the problem, just the mechanical process of planning the budget and accounting for every cent in the budget.
Right.
Then there's also the distributed politics of budgets, right? Budgeting is a political process that, and we should accept it as such. The expectation that politicians would be different, they would be just disinterested, apolitical planners, you know, efficiently allocating the budget, that's ludicrous, right? We should accept that there's distributed politics in budgets, meaning that, you know, politicians want to win elections, they have people who funded their campaigns, and that's part of the process of getting things done.
So there's a certain amount of money is going to go back to those people that supported them, and that's just part of the system.
Absolutely. That's part of the system. It's a feature of the process, not a bug. And so, you know, instead of wishing that this didn't happen, reforms could acknowledge that fact and bring some of those processes above board and make them more transparent so that, you know, if X contributed money to your campaign and you intend on giving them contracts, well and good, but it should be public that, you know, X contributed to your campaign and you've given them a contract, and then let the public and parliament adjudicate over the matter. As opposed to always, you know, moralizing about corruption and pretending that we can just wish it all away. And then you can, you know, there's a subsidiary implication here, which is that if you acknowledge that, then you can make that the transactions that we call cost of doing business more efficient and less distortionary. Because if everyone has to hide their lobbying, right, it creates all kinds of obfuscations. And so being above board with all these transactions means that we can make the processes more efficient and have the money flow quicker than currently happens.
Okay, that's interesting. Another point that you bring up is the idea that if you want African governments to use their budgets more effectively for their populations, that local think tanks could play a very useful role of advising the government on good policy, but that they need more support to play that role. How much influence do local think tanks have now on, you know, African governments and their decision making?
I'd say that, you know, a lot of civil society organizations in Africa are still very much in the 90s mode of lots of, you know, demonstrations, NGO type work. And there's need to obviously move into the think tank world where these outfits can provide alternative policies. So if the government says, we're trying to reform the curriculum to meet the current job market, right? They present their proposal, an education think tank presents its counter proposal, and then the public debates this, right?
Right.
Or, you know, they present a budget on agriculture and there's a think tank that does ag that can actually think through the issues and present a counter proposal.
As they do in many countries. And, you know,
yes. Right. Yeah. I think that would be a good way to move forward, as opposed to now, where, you know, most reform processes in African governments are typically channeled through the executive. A donor will position a technical advisor in the ministry, get a Scandinavian model, copy paste it. That's it. As opposed to having people who are actually on the ground thinking through these things and presenting counter proposals, having the public debate it. Because I think local think tanks have the advantage of knowing a lot more about the political context. And, you know, they're often also patient because they have the long-term view, because some policy interventions take a lot of time. So that eventually you'd have this nice ecosystem of former think tankers working for parliament or the executive and vice versa, to build that thick policy knowledge and expertise that you really need to get government working.
Right, right, right. So finally, as you know, the African Department at the IMF is marking its 60th year. And you argue that institutions like the IMF should be encouraging this idea of more involvement by elected officials in managing budgets. But how would they do that? I mean, it's one thing to engage with a country on the fiscal side, but it's quite another to get involved with politicians. How do you see that happening without it becoming very politicized and messy?
I guess my first answer would be that, you know, the politicization and messiness is inevitable, right? If you really want to get anything done, then it has to be, given the stakes involved, it has to be political and messy. It's impossible to have an apolitical budget process. And then secondly, I would say that, you know, as a practical matter, right, I think the fund could benefit from, you know, having expertise in politics, right? With the fund and the World Bank and many multilateral donor organizations are very heavy on economists and not enough on political expertise, which I've always found odd. Full disclosure, I'm a political scientist. I've always found it odd, right, that, you know, the entities that deal with these very deeply political processes don't find the need to have political expertise as part of their arsenal, because that would allow for smarter engagement with local politics, and also thinking of avenues of engaging legislatures or parties in structured ways that do not politicize the fund, right? The fund has an apolitical mission, but, you know, I think there are ways of just having rules of engagement so that if you're doing X in country Y, here are the list of people that need to provide input, here are the core players that need to sign off on any agreement, and expand that list to include, you know, at least the budget committee and the speakers of national assemblies and parliaments, to give voice to that important institution in the process. You know, it breaks my heart when members of parliament, right, appear in the news wanting to see details of an IMF agreement with their own government, right? That's a situation that should never exist. Parliament should be part and parcel of the process. We decry secrecy in contracts and government projects, and we should also decry secrecy or just, you know, dealing with a few people in the executive branch when it comes to engagements by international financial institutions or bilateral donors.
Well, Ken Opalo, this has been a really interesting conversation. I thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This is absolutely wonderful.
Ken Opalo is an assistant professor in Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. He was talking with journalist Rhoda Metcalf about his article in a special finance and development online series that marks the 60th anniversary of the IMF African Department. Check it out at imf.org/FND or download the Finance and Development app. And look for other IMF podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe if you like what you're hearing. You can also follow us on Twitter at @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards.
And I'm Rhoda Metcalf. Thanks for listening.